America, it's part of the world.
Yeah.
You know, it's you find that perspectives differ, and because perspectives differ, they offer insights that you may not be privy to based on your socialization or geographic location.
Exactly.
And so that for me is a marvel, and I'm getting excited that now that we have that opportunity.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So one keeps in mind there's no one African film.
Absolutely.
It's a multi
myriad,
multiform.
Absolutely.
So this has been fantastic.
I just feel like I could ask you questions for hours. Fascinating, so interesting to talk with. Just grateful that you were able to come here.
Thank you. Spend time with us today. It's a privilege.
Yes, and tonight it's at the Hollywood Theater.
Hollywood Theater, 6:30 and 9:30 showings. I will be there.
Excellent.
Excited to be in Portland. It's fantastic. It's always fun.
Okay, thank you for being here.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Listener supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. Today we continue celebrating Black History Month with a program recently restored thanks to a grant funded in part by the Grammy Foundation. The program is from our New York station WBAI and was broadcast back in 1967 at the height of the Civil Rights Movement. In an artistic response to what was happening in the 1960s, Baird Searles and the 99.5 Radio Theater broadcast The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns, a performance of a play for radio adapted from original court documents and letters by playwright and historian Jonathan Ned Katz and directed by Lois Adler.
A bill of sale was written out as follows. I, Charles F. Suttle, in consideration of $1,200 to me paid, do release A. Burns from all claims and service to me, hereby giving him his liberty forever.
Anthony Burns was born a slave in Stafford County, Virginia, in 1834. After escaping slavery on a ship bound for Boston, Massachusetts in 1853, he was captured a year later and became the center of the 1854 court case using the recently passed 1850 Fugitive Slave Act. The voices are those of Niger Okoni, Susan Batson, Alan Becker, Gerald Fritz, Robert Lander, Margot Lewettin, Frank McPhee, David Margolis, Eric Nord, Douglas Ross, and Baird Searles. Interspersed is music especially selected for this program by From the Vault producer Mark Torres. And now here is The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns from 1967 on WBAI.
The 99.5 Radio Theater.
Anthony Burns. Until my 10th year, I did not care what became of me. But soon after, I began to feel the necessity for freedom of soul and body. I heard of a North where men of my color could live without any man daring to say to them, "You are my property." I determined one day to find my way there.
Dispute over the ownership of Anthony Burns.
Boston, 8 o'clock, Wednesday evening, May 24th, 1854. Anthony Burns Colored was returning home from work in the shop of Coffin Pitts, where he was employed cleaning old clothes, when he was accosted by police officer Asa O. Butman and charged with having robbed a jewelry store the previous day. Six men immediately rushed forth to the assistance of the officer. Encircling the prisoner, they quickly had him off his feet, took him in their arms horizontally, as they would a dead man, and avoiding the sidewalk, rapidly bore him down the center of the street to the courthouse. At the entrance, the United States Marshal, Watson Freeman, stood with a drawn sword awaiting their appearance. The prisoner was hurried up several flights of stairs to a room at the top of the building. There, Anthony Burns was charged under the United States Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 with having escaped from the service and labor of Charles F. Suttle, a merchant and slave owner of Alexandria, Virginia. Within 20 minutes, the door was thrown open and the United States Marshal entered the room accompanied by two men, Charles F. Suttle and his agent, William Brent.
William Brent, friend of Colonel Charles F. Suttle, was present at the confrontation between Suttle and Burns in the courthouse right after the arrest. On Colonel Suttle's entering the room, the first word from Burns was, "How do you do, Master Charles?" Colonel Suttle then said, "How came you here?" Burns said he did not intend to run away, that an accident had happened to him. He was working down at Roberts on board a vessel, got tired, went to sleep, was carried off in the vessel. Colonel Suttle then asked, "Did I ever whip you, Anthony?" The answer was, "No, sir." The next question, "Did I ever hire you out where you did not want to go?" The reply was, "No, sir." The next question, "Did you ever ask me for money when it was not given you?" The answer was, "No, sir." Colonel Suttle then said, "Did I not, when you were sick, take my bed from my own house for you?" The answer was, "Yes, sir." Being asked if he was willing to go back, he said he was. Colonel Suttle then said, "I make you no promises, and I make you no threats."
"Caleb Page, teamster. Own my own team. Was asked to assist in arresting a man by Mr. Butman. He saying, 'You are just the man I want.' Was present at the conversation between Burns and Suttle in the courthouse. Suttle asked Burns if he did not come in Captain Snow's vessel. Burns replied that he did not. Suttle then asked what vessel he did come in. I did not hear the reply."
Benjamin True, constable. First saw the prisoner on the night of his arrest, was asked to go into the marshal's office. Marshal Freeman said he wanted to use me. He told me to go up the stairs to a room where there was a prisoner. Found five or six men there. My instructions were to see that no one came except by the direction of the marshal. The marshal and others came into the room Wednesday night. There was a good deal of talk between the officers and Burns. He first appeared terrified.
The examination.
Richard H. Dana, Jr., lawyer, constitutionalist, Thursday, May 25th. This morning at a little before 9, as I happened to be going past the courthouse, a gentleman told me that there was a fugitive slave in custody in the courtroom, and that the proceedings were about to begin. I went up immediately and saw a Negro sitting in the usual place for prisoners, handcuffed and guarded by a large corps of officers. He seemed completely cowed and dispirited. I offered to act as his counsel. He said, "It is of no use. They will get me back, and if they do, I shall fare worse if I resist." I told him there might be some flaw in the papers, or some mistake, and then he might get off. He could not say what he wanted to do. The claimant, one Colonel Suttle of Virginia, was present and sat in full sight of the Negro the whole time. I would not press defense upon him under these conditions, but felt it my duty to address the court and ask for delay.
Were you there causes me to tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when the sun refused to shine? Oh, were you there when the sun refused to shine? Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble.
I cannot say that I am regularly of counsel for the accused. From the few words I have been enabled to hold with him, I am satisfied that he is not in a condition to determine whether he will have counsel or not, or whether he will defend. I submit to Your Honor's judgment that time should be allowed to the prisoner to recover himself from the stupefaction of his sudden arrest and distressing situation, and have opportunity to determine what counsel he will pursue.
Seth J. Thomas, Esquire, counsel for the claimant Suttle. I oppose the motion. Mr. Dana himself says that the prisoner does not wish for counsel, does not wish for defense. The only object of delay is to try to induce him to resist the just claim which he is now ready to acknowledge. The delay will cause great inconvenience to the claimant and his witness, both of whom have come all the way from Virginia and will be delayed here a day or two if the adjournment is granted.
The counsel for Suttle misapprehends my statement. I did not say the prisoner did not wish counsel and defense. I said he was evidently not in a state to say what he wishes to do. He has just been arrested and brought into court, surrounded by strangers, faced with the immense issue of freedom or slavery. The counsel for the claimant objects to a delay on the grounds of the inconvenience to which it will put the claimant and his witness. I think he mistakes the character of this tribunal by addressing to it such an argument as that. We have not yet come to that state in which we weigh liberty against convenience and freedom against pecuniary expense.
Theodore Parker, clergyman, abolitionist. The commissioner asked Burns if he wanted time to think of the matter and counsel to aid in his defense. I shall never forget how the accused man looked around the courtroom at the marshal, the commissioner, the claimant's lawyer, and his witness. Save for Dana, whom he had never seen before, there was scarce a friendly face. At length he said, timidly, and catching for breath, "Yes."
The attack on the courthouse.
Thomas Wentworth Higginson, pastor of the Free Church, Worcester, Massachusetts. On Thursday evening, May 25th, I had a letter by private messenger from Boston saying that a slave had been arrested, that a public protest meeting was to be held at Faneuil Hall. Going to Boston on the morning train, I found myself at a meeting of the Anti-Slavery Society. It is impossible to conceive a set of men personally admirable, yet less fitted than this committee to undertake any positive action of forcible resistance to authorities. There was not only no plan of action, but no set plan of united action. At one moment, when there seemed a slight prospect of practical agreement, someone came in to announce that Suttle and his men, the slave catchers, were soon to pass by, and proposed that we should go out and gaze at them, pointing the finger of scorn, as if Southern slave catchers were to be combated by such measures. The meeting adjourned till afternoon, when matters were still worse, mere talk and discussion. It seemed to me, at least, that something must be done. My hopes now rested on Martin Stowell, a man of remarkable energy, who had taken part in a slave rescue at Syracuse, New York. Stowell was to arrive from Worcester at 6 p.m. I met him at the train. He heard the condition of affairs and at once suggested a plan. The man must be taken from the courthouse. It could not be done in cold blood, but the effort must have behind it the momentum of a public meeting, such as it was to be held in Faneuil Hall that night. Let all be in readiness. Let a picked body be distributed near the courthouse, and then send some loud-voiced speaker who should appear in the gallery of Faneuil Hall and announce that there was a mob of Negroes already attacking the courthouse. Let a speaker, previously warned, accept the opportunity promptly and send the whole meeting pell-mell to Court Square, ready to fall in behind the leaders and bring out the slave. Those of us who had been told to be ready in Court Square went there singly, not to attract attention. Planting myself near a door which stood ajar, I waited for the mob of people to appear from Faneuil Hall. The moment seemed endless. Would our friends never arrive? Presently, a rush of running figures like the sweep of a wave came round the corner of Court Square. I watched with breathless anxiety. The crowd ran on pell-mell. I scanned it for a familiar face. A single glance brought the conviction of failure. The men on the platform, the real nucleus of that great gathering, were far in the rear, perhaps were still clogged in the crowded hall. Mingling with the crowd, I ran against Stowell, who had been looking for the axes which I had stored at a friend's office in Court Square. He whispered, "Some of our men are bringing a beam up to the west door that gives entrance to the upper stairway." Instantly, he and I ran round and grasped the beam, I finding myself at the head with a stout Negro opposite me. The real attack had begun. Taking the joist up the steps, we hammered away at the southwest door of the courthouse. It could not have been many minutes before it began to give way, was secured again, then swung ajar and rested heavily. One hinge parted. There was room for but one to pass in. I glanced instinctively at my black ally. He did not even look at me, but sprang in first, I following. We found ourselves inside, face to face with six or eight policemen, who laid about them with their clubs, driving us to the wall and hammering away at our heads. Hands were powerless against clubs, although my burly comrade wielded his lustily. All other thoughts merged in this, the expectation of reinforcements. I did not know till next morning that just as the door sprang open, a shot had been fired, and one of the marshal's deputies, a man named Batchelder, had fallen dead. I only knew that we were gradually forced back beyond the threshold, the door standing now wide open, and our supporters having fallen back to leave the steps free. I held my place outside, still hoping against hope that some concerted reinforcements might appear. Meanwhile, the deputy marshals retreated to the stairway over which they aimed their pistols. The moments passed on. In the silent pause that ensued, I was struck with the strongest impression of the great want of preparation on our part for this revolutionary work. Brought up as we all have been, it takes the whole experience of one such case to educate the mind to the attitude of revolution. It takes time to prepare oneself to act coolly and wisely, as well as courageously, in such an emergency. Two companies of artillery had been ordered out, and two more of marines, the attempt to rescue Burns being a failure and troops approaching. I went down the steps.
telegraphic communication between the United States Marshal in Boston and the President of the United States.
Boston, in consequence of an attack on the courthouse last night for the purpose of rescuing a fugitive slave, I now have two companies of United States troops from Fort Independence stationed in the courthouse. Everything is quiet. Watson Freeman, United States Marshal.
Washington, your conduct is approved. The law must be executed. Franklin Pierce, President.
The Boston Courier, Sunday, May 28th. Colonel Suttle stated yesterday that he was willing to sell Burns for his fair market value as a slave. A bill of sale was written out as follows. I, Charles F. Suttle, in consideration of $1,200 to me paid, do release A. Burns from all claims and service to me, hereby giving him his liberty forever.
You are listening to The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns, a performance of a play for radio adapted from original court documents and letters by playwright and historian Jonathan Ned Katz and directed by Lois Adler and broadcast on WBAI in New York City in 1967. This program was digitized and preserved thanks to a grant funded in part by the Grammy Foundation and Pacifica Station listeners. This is the first time it has been heard since its original broadcast. For a copy of the original program without the selected music, please visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now back to the radio drama, The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns, from WBAI in New York City.
The amount specified by the owner as the price of the man was raised immediately to purchase Burns' freedom. It was hoped that the bargain would have been consummated last night. And so confident were certain parties of it that the money in specie was ready. A carriage was at the door and several merchants stood ready to see the man delivered. But Suttle then averred that he must also have all expenses paid and said finally that he was counseled not to give the man up at any price.
The trial.
The counsel for the accused moves for a further delay to prepare for the defense. We need more time. Only a brief delay has been granted us in a case which will decide between an alleged right of property and a man's freedom or slavery for life. If the case involved only the theft of a coat, the wheels of justice could not be turned in months.
Counsel for Suttle. My client has letters from very respectable people in the state from which he comes. He says that one, Anthony Burns, who owes him servitude, has escaped. He asks if there is any means to take him back to the state from which he escaped. If there is a law whereby my client has property in this man and this claim is proved, there is but one thing to be done by the magistrate. A certificate is to be made out and the prisoner returned. There are no more grounds for delay than in a case where my client had a promissory note from a man and proceeded under the law to claim it. Gentlemen may not like the law, but it is nevertheless the law.
Court rules. The trial must proceed.
William Brent, merchant, Richmond, Virginia. I am in the grocery commission business. Owned slaves myself. Acquired some by marriage, later became interested in others. Have bought some. Never sold any myself. Further than that, never traded in slaves. I am acquainted with Colonel Charles F. Suttle. Have been for a long time. Was born within 3 miles of Colonel Suttle. Known him ever since I can recollect. Know all his family. Know Burns as a slave in Stafford County for 12 or 15 years. When not hired out, Burns lived with Colonel Suttle. Previous to his being hired out, he was a big boy, not capable of doing anything. When Burns was hired out by Suttle, the wages went to Suttle. Hired him out myself. Hired him out as agent for Colonel Suttle. When I hired Burns, I gave my bond to Suttle, who claimed to own him. When Suttle sent Burns to be hired out, he described him as his boy. It is customary in Virginia to give passes to slaves when they go about. Burns had such a pass when he came to my house in Richmond. When Colonel Suttle was desirous of making some pecuniary transaction, he gave a mortgage on his property, including this man Burns, in order to raise the money. He then stated that Burns was one of his slaves. I last saw Burns on the 20th of March.
Counsel for the accused. The record Suttle brings describes a dark-complexioned man. Says he has a scar on one of his cheeks. It says he has a scar on his right hand. The prisoner has on his right cheek a brand or burn nearly as wide as the palm of a man's hand. His right hand is broken and hangs almost useless. A bone stands out from the back of it. A slave's right hand is the chief property his master has in him. If that hand loses its power, no man remembers it as well as the master. It is extraordinary that neither the record nor Mr. Brent say anything about the most noticeable thing in the man. The proof of identity hangs on the testimony of one man. That man is Mr. Brent. Brent swears clearly and positively that he last saw Burns the 20th of March. We shall call a number of witnesses to prove that the prisoner was at work in Massachusetts on the 1st of March before the alleged escape.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways, thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Through the city's melted furnace, unexpectedly we watched, with faces hidden as the walls were tightening. As the echo of the wedding bells before the blowing rain dissolved into the bells of the lightning. Tolling for the rebel, tolling for the rake, tolling for the luckless, they are abandoned and forsake. Tolling for the outcast, burning constantly at stake. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Through the mad, mystic hammering of the wild, ripping hail, the sky cracked its palms in naked wonder at the clinging of the church bells, blew far into the breeze, leaving only bells of lightning and its thunder. Striking for the gentle, striking for the kind, striking for the guardians and protectors of the mind. And the poet and the painter far behind his rightful time. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. in the wild cathedral evening. The rain unraveled tales for the disrobed, faceless forms of no position. Tolling for the tongues with no place to bring their thoughts, all down in taken for granted situations. Tolling for the deaf and blind, tolling for the mute, for the mistreated mateless mother, the mistitled prostitute, for the misdemeanor outlaw, chained and cheated by pursuit. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
William Jones, colored, am a laborer, know the accused. Saw him first on Washington Street the first day of March. He was alone. He spoke to me first. He asked me if I knew of anyone that wanted a man to work in a store. I said, what can you do? He said, I can do most anything. Took him from there to Mr. Russell's bootblack shop the day I saw him. Asked Mr. Russell to put it down in my book. Can't write myself. Burns went home with me to South Boston. It was night when we arrived home. It was a little cold. There might have been snow on the ground. He stayed with me that night, the next night, and the next, and the next. I got up the next day, washed my face and hands, went to the Mattapan Iron Works, saw Mr. Sawyer, the boss. Talked with him about a job. Burns was with me all the time. I implored him to go to work on the fourth day of March in the Mattapan Works at South Boston. We worked at cleaning windows. He worked with me 5 days. I agreed to give him 8 cents a window. When he got through with the windows, I gave him a dollar and a half. He said I hadn't settled up with him right. He went to the clerk about it. He stayed with me until the 18th. Never put eyes on him again till Sunday morning, when I saw him look out of the window of the courthouse. I stood on the opposite side. His head was out of the window. I heard there was a man arrested, and I didn't believe. First heard him call Anthony Burns on Thursday. A man read it from the newspaper. I called him John, Jack, or any short name that came handy. Nobody spoke to me about being a witness here. I came here because I saw this man looking out of the window.
George H. Drew was bookkeeper at the Mattapan Works. Jones was employed about the 1st of March. There was a colored man working with him. I looked at the man and asked Jones if the man was his brother. He said, all men are my brothers. Yesterday came in here, and when I saw Burns, I recognized him as the man. About the 1st of March, after I settled with Jones, Burns came to me and asked me how much I paid Jones. Have no doubt about the identity of the man. Saw him enough to recognize him. When I came in yesterday, Burns followed me around the room with his eyes.
James F. Whitmore, machinist. Last March, was connected with the Mattapan Works. Know the man at the bar. Saw him on the 8th or 9th of March at our shop at South Boston. I then noticed the mark on his cheek and also the mark on his right hand. The firm failed in April. The first time that I have seen Burns since was this morning. No one asked me to come here. I have no particular interest in this case. Do not lie under the imputation of being a free soiler or abolitionist. I'm a conservative Whig.
John Favor, a carpenter. When I came into court, I recognized the accused as the man who came with Jones to my place for employment about the 1st of March. I have no doubt about it.
N.H. Gilman was a teamster at the Mattapan Works. We were paid the 1st of the month. It was near payday that I remember Jones working there and having a colored man with him. and noticed a scar upon his face. The next time I saw him was in court this morning.
Horace A. Brown, police officer. Have seen the accused before. He was cleaning windows at the Mattapan Works. I was at work there as a carpenter. I left work there the 20th of March. The accused was at work there about 10 days before I left.
The counsel for the claimant proposes to put into the record the statements of the prisoner since his arrest.
The counsel for the accused calls the attention of the court to the 6th section of the Fugitive Slave Act, which expressly provides that the testimony of the alleged fugitive shall not be taken.
The counsel for Suttle views Burns' admissions and confessions since his arrest as a very different thing from testimony.
According to the interpretation of this court, the law prohibits the acceptance of testimony or evidence given by the accused as a witness. Law does not, however, prohibit the acceptance of confessions or admissions used only to establish the identity of the accused with the fugitive, in this case, Anthony Burns.
You are listening to The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns, a performance of a play for radio adapted from original court documents and letters by playwright and historian Jonathan Ned Katz and directed by Lois Adler and broadcast on WBAI in New York City in 1967. This program was digitized and preserved thanks to a grant funded in part by the Grammy Foundation and Pacifica Station listeners. This is the first time it has been heard since its original broadcast. For a copy of the original program without the selected music, please visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now back to the radio drama, The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns, from WBAI in New York City.
The statements of the prisoner on the night of his arrest, as described by the witness Brent, were entered into the record.
Telegraphic communication between a United States officer in Boston and the President of the United States.
Boston. Trial is over. Decision pending. Armed resistance is indicated. 2 companies on duty. The marshal has all the armed posse he can muster. More will be needed to execute the extradition if ordered. If called out by the mayor at the marshal's request, can the necessary expenses of the city military be paid by the United States government?
Washington, incur any expense.
Charlotte L. Fortin, 16 years old, student, Salem, Massachusetts, colored. The trial is over at last. The commissioner's decision will be given tomorrow. We are all in the greatest suspense. What will that decision be? Alas, that anyone should have the power to decide the right of a fellow being. It is thought by many that he will be acquitted of the great crime of leaving a life of bondage, as the legal evidence is not thought sufficient to convict him. Sarah Raymond and I went to Boston in the morning. Still much real indignation and excitement prevail. We walk past the courthouse, which is lawlessly converted into a prison and filled with soldiers, some of whom were looking from the windows with an air of insolent authority which made my blood boil. Dined at Mr. Garrison's. At the table, I watched earnestly the expression of that noble face as he spoke beautifully in support of the non-resistant principles to which he has kept firm. His is indeed the very highest Christian spirit to which I cannot hope to reach, for I believe in resistance to tyrants and would fight for liberty until death.
The Boston Courier, Thursday, June 1st. Intense excitement prevails throughout the city. Thousands of curious people have gathered around the courthouse, and several arrests for disorderly conduct have been made. The remarks of Mr. W.C. Fay excited the ire of a Negro, Wilson Hopewell, who struck Mr. Fay. When Officer William Tarleton intervened, a violent struggle ensued. Officers Riley, Cheswell, and Rogers came to the rescue, and Hopewell was taken to the watch house. A difficulty has been experienced in finding food for the soldiers. The eating houses near the courthouse were thronged by visitors, and Mr. J.B. Smith's colored waiters refused to serve the military.
Decision.
Edward G. Loring, United States Commissioner and Professor of Law, Harvard University. The issue between the parties arises under the U.S. Statute of 1850. For the accused, it is urged that the statute is unconstitutional. In this connection, the wise words of our revered Chief Justice may well be repeated now and remembered always. The Chief Justice says, "Slavery was not created, established, or perpetuated by the Constitution. It existed before. It would have existed if the Constitution had not been made. The regulation of slavery, so far as to prohibit states from harboring fugitive slaves, was an essential element in the Constitution's formation. The provision it contains was the best adjustment which could be made of conflicting rights and claims, and was absolutely necessary to effect the general pacification. The Union intended to be established by it was essentially necessary to the peace, happiness, and highest prosperity of all the states. In this spirit, it seems to be the duty of all magistrates to apply these provisions in the Constitution and laws of the United States. I Edward J. Loring, United States Commissioner, rule the statute of 1850 constitutional. The identity of the accused with the Anthony Burns owned by the claimant is the only question I have a right to consider. In every case of disputed identity, there is one person whose knowledge is perfect and positive, and whose evidence is not within the reach of error. That is the person whose identity is questioned. Such evidence this case affords. The evidence is of the conversation between Burns and Suttle, which took place on the night of the arrest. To me, this evidence, when applied to the question of identity, confirms and establishes the testimony of Mr. Brent. My mind is satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt of the identity of the accused with the Anthony Burns of the record. On the law and the facts of the case, I consider Charles F. Suttle entitled to the certificate which he claims.
Telegraphic communication of a Boston official to the President of the United States.
The commissioner has granted the certificate. Fugitive to be removed today. Ample military and police force to effect it peacefully. Law reigns.
Theodore Parker, clergyman. Boston is in a state of siege. We are living under military rule. The day is brilliant. There is not a cloud. All about Boston, the green of June, the grass, the trees, the heavens, the light. What a day for Boston. Citizens applaud that a man is to be carried off into bondage. Drunken soldiers in the street sing, "Oh, carry me back to old Virginny."
Notice of the mayor to the citizens of Boston. Under the excitement that now pervades the city, you are respectfully requested to cooperate in the maintenance of peace and order. Let every good citizen go quietly about his business. The laws must be obeyed, the consequences be what they may.
On the day of Burns' removal, the chief of police instructed police captain Joseph K. Hayes to draw his men in a line across Commercial Street, cause them to join hands, and force back the crowd to Milk Street, where he was to hold them. Captain Hayes was further instructed that if his force should be unable to hold back the crowd, they were to swing back, right, and left. This was to be a signal to the military at the other end of the street to fire upon the crowd. Captain Hayes listened to his instructions and wrote a note.
To His Honor, the Mayor of the City of Boston. I have received an order which, if performed, would implicate me in the execution of the Fugitive Slave Bill. I therefore resign the office which I have held as Captain of the Police from this hour, 11 o'clock.
Editorial, The New York Daily Times.
The cost to the federal government of the armed forces mobilized in the Burns case is estimated at $40,000. A large share of this is paid by the slaveholding states. The value of Burns is estimated at $1,200. At this rate, the return of a fugitive is certainly not profitable from a pecuniary point of view. But the conservative influence of such recoveries on the minds of slaves is probably considered in the South a sufficient indemnity for the financial loss.
After the decision, Burns remained in the courtroom awaiting the hour of his departure. At length, Deputy Marshal Riley entered the room and ordered the prisoner to be handcuffed. Burns said that unless he was allowed to go unshackled, he would make every demonstration of violence within his power. After some discussion, the request was granted.
As the preparations for the removal of Burns were being completed, a detachment of United States troops from Forts Independence and Constitution were marched out of the courthouse. Each man's musket was duly inspected. Out of the courthouse next came 120 special officers who formed a hollow square directly in front of the entrance. This body of special aides was well armed, each man with a drawn Roman sword on his right side and a loaded revolver in his belt. Burns was escorted out of the courthouse by United States Marshal Watson Freeman and six of his aides who took their post in the center of the hollow square. Burns appeared as indifferent as the most uninterested spectator. The cries which greeted his appearance did not seem to excite him.
A procession was formed in the following order: a detachment of National Lancers, a corps of United States Artillery, a corps of United States Marines. The hollow square of special officers, in the center of which was the United States Marshal, his aides, and the fugitive Anthony Burns. A corps of United States Marines. A small brass cannon drawn by a span of horses and manned by six members of the United States Artillery. A corps of United States Marines.
Passing down State Street, the procession was greeted with mingled groans, cheers, and hisses. The most intense interest was manifested to get a parting glimpse of the fugitive. There are a lot of folks, said Burns, to see a colored man walk down the street. The procession moved slowly to the wharf on which a United States revenue cutter was lying. Burns was marched directly aboard and disappeared from sight.
At the wharf, a colored man named William Jones, a witness at the trial, was arrested by the police for using inflammatory language.
The cutter with Burns was delayed about 1 hour due to the labor of getting the small cannon on board. At 3:15, the word to cast off was given. At precisely 3:20, the cutter swung from the wharf and proceeded down the harbor.
As the cutter moved out, it passed a steamer carrying a group of southern merchants to a commercial convention. Crowding to the rail, the businessmen witnessed the passing of the cutter carrying Anthony Burns, and their band struck up the Star Spangled Banner.
Henry David Thoreau, July 4th, 1854. Since Massachusetts has deliberately sent back Anthony Burns to slavery, I have lived with the sense of having suffered a vast and indefinite loss. I did not know at first what ailed me. At last it occurred to me that I had lost a country. I had foolishly thought that I might manage to live here, minding my private affairs. I dwelt before in the illusion that my life passed somewhere between heaven and hell. But now, I cannot persuade myself that I do not dwell wholly within hell. Suppose you have a small library, with pictures to adorn the walls, a garden laid out around, and contemplate scientific and literary pursuits, and discover, all at once, that your villa, with all its contents, is located in hell, and that the justice of the peace has a cloven foot and forked tail. Do not these things suddenly lose their value? I am surprised to see men going about their business as if nothing had happened. I say to myself, they have not heard the news. I walk toward one of our ponds. The remembrance of my country spoils my walk. My thoughts are murder to the state and go plotting against her.
At the same July 4th meeting at which Thoreau spoke, William Lloyd Garrison exclaimed, "So perish all compromise with tyranny," and burned copies of the Fugitive Slave Law, the decision in the Burns case, and the United States Constitution.
The 99.5 Radio Theater has presented The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns, adapted from the original documents by John Katz and directed by Lois Adler. The program was produced for the 99.5 Radio Theater by Baird Searles and John Katz. Technical assistance by Ed Woodard.
Now that's the end of the radio drama, but not necessarily the end of the story for the dispute over the ownership of Anthony Burns. On February 22nd in 1855, Reverend Leonard A. Grimes of Boston's 12th Baptist Church led efforts to raise money for the purchase of Anthony Burns' freedom. Acting through intermediaries, Grimes purchased Burns, who then returned to Massachusetts a free man. Burns later studied at Oberlin College in Ohio and became a minister in Canada. Burns died in 1862. And that does it for this week's From the Vault. You've been listening to The Dispute Over the Ownership of Anthony Burns, a performance of a play for radio adapted from the original court documents and letters by playwright and historian Jonathan Ned Katz and directed by Lois Adler and produced by the 99.5 Radio Theater of WBAI New York City back in 1967. For a copy of this program or programs in this series, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres with support from the Pacifica Radio Archives staff. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, funded in part by Pacifica Station listeners. Current preservation projects are funded in part by grants from the Grammy Foundation and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is hiring a data coordinator. Our data coordinator supports KBOO's fundraising activities by organizing donor information, tabulating contributions and campaign totals, and maintains KBOO's database. Experience working with DonorPerfect or similar data management platforms.